right, let's open up our Bibles to the book of Psalms. And we find ourselves beginning today in the 140th Psalm, Psalm 140. Now, we find several of these Psalms in front of us now where you'll notice that David is the author of them. And I think one of the remarkable things about the life of David is the incredible number of enemies that this man had. He had the kind of personality where you just couldn't really take a neutral stand on the guy. He either loved him or hated him. And he had a lot of guys throughout the entire course of his life that hated him and were out to get him. But at each point, David would just bring these issues before the Lord and want the Lord to handle them for him. And I think that you can learn you can learn a lot by listening to the prayers of a seasoned believer. And I think that's one of the benefits of the book of Psalms, is that when we read the Psalms of David, we are listening into the prayers of a man that walked many years with the Lord, knew the Lord for many years, and how he presents his needs before the Lord, I think, are very insightful for you and I. So beginning in verse 1 of Psalm 140, he said, "Deliver me, O Lord, from evil men, and preserve me from violent men who plan evil things in their hearts, and they continually gather together for war, and they sharpen their tongues like a serpent. And the poison of a serpent is under their lips. Keep me, O Lord, from the hands of the wicked, and preserve me from violent men who have purpose to make my steps stumble. The proud have hidden a snare for me in their cords, and they have spread a net by the wayside, and they have set traps for me. And I said to the Lord, 'You are my God, and hear the voice of my supplications, O Lord. O God, the Lord, the strength of my salvation, you have covered my head in the day of battle. Do not grant, O Lord, the desires of the wicked, and do not further his wicked schemes, lest they be exalted. As for the head of those that surround me, let evil of their lips cover them, and let burning of coals fall upon them, and let them be cast into the fire and into the deep pits that rise not up again. And let them that slander be established, let not them that slander be established in the earth, and let the evil hunt the violent man and overthrow him. I know the Lord, that he will maintain the cause of the afflicted and the justice of the poor. Surely the righteous shall give thanks unto your name, and the upright shall dwell in your presence." And so David is simply praying that these people would experience just the reaping and sowing process. Now they've hurt people and they've damaged people, and now, Lord, let that simply come upon them. And notice how that David was praying for discernment. I know that these guys are setting traps. These guys are out to mess up my life. And so, Lord, give me insight. And David, you know, David knew that he wasn't strong. And that's why he was so strong, right? David knew that he wasn't wise. And that's what made him so wise. I mean, the thing that caused David to be such the powerful man that he was is that he knew, "I'm not a powerful man." And so David continued just to bring everything and cast everything to God in prayer. And of course, Psalm 141 reflects that again, that every line of 141 is a prayer. And David was very gifted at giving all things and carrying all things to God in prayer, like the hymn, right? What a friend we have in Jesus. What a privilege to be able to carry everything to God in prayer. Joseph Skivern, the guy that wrote that particular hymn, he didn't write it to become a hymn. He actually wrote it in a letter to his mother. He was living in Canada. His mother was deathly ill in Ireland. He wasn't able to get there. And so he wrote this in a letter that, you know, "Look, what a friend we have in the Lord. And, you know, what needless pain we often, you know, bear, all because we will not, you know, carry everything to God in prayer," and so forth. And as she read it, she thought, "Wowee, this be a good song." And so it's turned into a song. But it was a letter from a man just encouraging his mom that, "Look, you're facing something that's bigger than you are. And so just give it to the Lord in prayer." And that's what David is doing here. Now, David, he's asking for three things. Number one, in verse one, he says, "Lord, I cry out unto you, and make haste to me. Give ear unto my voice when I cry unto you, and let my prayers be set before you as incense in the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice." And number one, I want you to listen to me, God. Now, If God isn't listening, then what is the point of prayer, right? I mean, what is the point of just, you know, sending our words into the atmosphere? There's no point at all. So, God, I want you to listen. And notice how that David, he understands that these activities, these physical activities that were going on there in the temple, actually had spiritual implications. And you can imagine David is standing there in his temple or in his palace and overlooking, you know, the tabernacle and seeing this incense rising up. David has spiritual eyes to understand that that's sort of like the prayers of the believer. I think twice in the book of Revelation, it speaks about how the prayers of the saints come before the Lord in the form of incense. And so David is saying, let my prayers come before you. Now, the interesting thing about that incense is that it was never to be duplicated. In other words, they weren't to use that incense outside the temple. I mean, you couldn't say, gee, that smells pretty good. I think I'm going to put that on the hearth at home. And you couldn't do that. It was never to be duplicated. It was always to be used there in the temple. Now, again, you remember that Jesus said that when you pray, you know, don't be given over to this vain repetition. That don't allow your prayers to just be a duplication of saying the same thing over and over again. You are in a relationship with God, and for a relationship to remain fresh, there has to be fresh communication. And so therefore, our prayers are not to be, you know, now I lay me down to sleep, you know, every night of your life. But, you know, mix it up a little bit, right? Keep the relationship between you and God fresh. So he said, in verse 3, the second thing that he wants, set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth, and watch over the door of my lips. Do not incline my heart to any evil thing, to practice wicked works with men who work iniquity, and do not let me eat of their delicacies. Now, he wants God to listen, but he also wants God to make him mature and to make him pure. And notice, not just guard my mouth, and not only help me to say the right thing or keep me from saying the wrong thing, but then to set a guard over my heart. My heart needs to be inclined in the right direction. The thing about the heart is that the heart rules our life. The heart will dominate our life. We oftentimes think, well, what we need is a change of environment. You know, here's this guy, he's historically struggled with so many things, and so, you know, if we can ship him overseas, if we can put him in a different environment. Now, granted, if there are evil influences in our life, then we should seek to put some distance between us and the evil influence. That's true enough. But unless the heart is changed, you can take a person and put them in a perfect environment, and somehow their corrupt heart will figure out a way to sabotage the perfect situation that you've put them in. There needs to be the conversion, the change of the heart. And that is what David is asking for here, because the heart, it will... You know what's right, but your heart will somehow override your logic. I remember talking to a guy a couple of years ago. He left his wife for another woman, and his wife was just the perfect woman in so many ways. And I met with this guy, and I said, now, look, help me out here. Help me understand this thing. And I went through all of the positives about his wife. Your wife is this, your wife is that. And then I went through the laundry list of the negatives of the woman that he left his wife for. And I said, look, you know, forget heaven and hell right now. Forget sin. I just need you to help me to understand the logic that you use to leave this to go to that. And he said a true thing. He said a true statement. He said, I have not one logical reason for the decision that I've made. But what happened was there came a point where his heart was leaning towards that evil, totally overrid his intellect and his logic. And so oftentimes sin is not reasonable. Sin is not logical, but our heart has been tilted towards evil, so to speak. And we fall prey to it. So David is saying here, look, don't let my heart lean in that direction. Notice verse 5, as he's talking about wanting to be sanctified, wanting to be pure, he says, let the righteous strike me, and it shall be kindness. Let him rebuke me, and it shall be as excellent as oil, and let not my head refuse it. For still my prayer is against the deeds of the wicked, and their judges are overthrown by the sides of the cliff. And they shall hear my words, and they are sweet. Our bones are scattered at the mouth of a cave, as when one plows and breaks up the earth. Now, part of our sanctification is the Lord using godly people in our life. And what David is saying is, now you bring a godly person into my life, they can slap me upside the head and keep me from going in the wrong direction. And then notice he also prays, and let my head not refuse it. When a righteous man comes into my life and tries to knock some sense into me, I can be resistant. But Lord, help me to be open to the words and the correction of those wise and spiritual men in my life. And then he uses some very picturesque language, doesn't he, in verse 7, that, you know, our bones are scattered. You know, they're just spread out over the grave. So here is a very dark time in David's life. But notice an important word, the beginning of verse 8, but my eyes are upon you, O God, the Lord. And in you I take refuge. Do not leave my soul destitute. Keep me from the snares that they have laid for me and from the traps of the workers of iniquity. Let the wicked fall into their own nets while I escape safely. Now notice his faith is still holding strong. Desperate situation, yes, in verse 7. But notice he says, my eyes are on you. Notice that he doesn't say, my eyes are on you and several other possible escape routes. No, my eyes are on you. God, if you don't come through, I'm dead. I do not have a plan B. You are the only plan that I've got in my life. And so if you don't come through, I'm dead. Now, notice the subtitle of 142, that it is a Michelle of David, a prayer when he was in the cave. Now, again, Michelle means instruction. There are 18 of these such psalms spread throughout the 150 psalms, and they were written specifically to bring instruction. So we learned, number one, that it is for instruction. We learned, number two, that it was written by David. We also understand that it was a prayer. And then the fourth thing we learned is that it was in a cave. Now, David is not supposed to be in a cave. David is supposed to be in a palace. And so the thing that makes 142 such an important prayer is that it is a prayer that is prayed by a man when he's supposed to be in a palace. Instead, he's waking up in a cave. Now, there are these moments in our life where we awake in less than an ideal situation. And I'm not supposed to be here. And this is not how my life is supposed to turn out. So when we find ourselves in a situation where our lives are not turning out as we had hoped, how do you pray? What do you pray? Well, notice what David prayed. He said, I cry out unto the Lord with my voice. With my voice to the Lord, I will make my supplications. I pour out my complaint before him, and I declare before him my trouble. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then you knew my path and the way in which I walked. And they have secretly set a snare for me. I look on my right hand and see, and there are none who will acknowledge me. And refuge has failed me, and no one cares for my soul. I cried out to you, O Lord, and I said, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Attend unto my cry, for I am brought very low, and deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than I. Bring my soul out of prison, that I may praise your name, and the righteous shall surround me, for you shall deal bountifully with me. Now, notice he uses the word cry in verse 1, and then he uses it again in verse 5, and these two words, cry, are the same word in the Hebrew, and they mean to shriek. So understand that this is not David saying a nice church prayer. This is a man that has absolutely no one in life. He is totally isolated of all of the people on earth. Nobody wants anything to do with him. Nobody will even acknowledge that they know him. I mean, this guy has been abandoned, and so he's in this cave. He should be in the palace, but he's in the cave, and he is shrieking. Now, again, what does a shriek sound like in a cave, right? I mean, I'm sure that this thing was just echoing, and he's losing it. But then He uses the word cry in verse 6, and that means a request for help. So you see what's happening here. He starts out, he's desperate, he's shrieking, but as he's just turning everything over to God in prayer, there is now a calmness coming. The decibel level is beginning to lower just a little bit. He's not screaming any longer, but he's simply requesting help. Now, notice that in verse 3, he's looking within. He looks inside of himself, and he sees a lot of despair. And then notice in verse 4, he's looking around. And what does he see when he looks around? He has been totally abandoned. Now, our problem is we spend much of our time looking within and looking around, and then we wonder why we're in a bad mood. We look in, and we're depressed, and we look around, and we feel alone, and we feel abandoned. But that's not where David stopped. Notice that the turnaround came in verse 5, that I cried out unto you, Lord. He started looking up, all right? I'm looking in, and I'm looking on the inside of a loser, all right? And I look around, and I'm seeing a world that doesn't want to have anything to do with me. And so he ends up being miserable and shrieking. But now he begins to look up, but not only does he look up, notice also in verse 7, he starts looking ahead. All right, I'm forgetting the past. I'm going to press on with what is in front of me. And looking up and looking ahead, notice he was delivered from that prison of despair. There's a lot of people, a lot of believers, a lot of people that name the name of Christ, they're walking around and they are just chronically depressed. It's because they spend their entire life looking within and looking around, looking at everything that's wrong, everything, every bad thing that's happened to them, rather than, look, taking the Lord and then realize, hey, God's got a plan for my life. My life counts, and there is rhyme, there is reason to my life, and God is going to do something in my life. Well, then in Psalm 143, notice he continues here to be praying for insight. Notice what he prays for in verse 1. He says, hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my supplications. In your faithfulness, answer me, and in your righteousness. So once again, he wants to be heard. But also notice what he wants. Verse 2, he doesn't want to be brought into judgment. That's a wise thing to pray for. Notice in verse 7, he says, answer me. But notice it's answer me speedily. I mean, isn't that the way it is? I mean, we want God to answer us yesterday. I mean, you know, God will lay something on our heart, and we want to meditate on it for 5.5 years before we move on it, right? But when we need God to do something for us, well, you got to do it now. Answer speedily. Notice in verse 8, cause me to hear. And then he says, cause me to know. And then in verse 9, he says, deliver me, O Lord. And then in verse 10, teach me. And then again in verse 10, lead me. And then in verse 11, he says, revive me. And then finally in verse 12, he says, cut off my enemies. So I think that, you know, one of the things that we see about the prayer life of David is that it covers all spectrum of the man's life. There is nothing wrong with praying when you're sick. There's nothing wrong with praying when you need money. There's nothing wrong with praying when you need food. You remember that Jesus said, he taught us to pray, give us this day our daily bread. There's nothing wrong with asking God for material things. But ask yourself this. I think that you can gauge the spiritual temperature of your prayer life by just analyzing what is it that you're asking for. If you're only asking for those material comforts of life, then you probably got a pretty cold prayer life. But notice, along with protection, along with deliverance and these kinds of things, he wants more godliness in his life. He wants God to be leading him. And so we're able to see that here is a man that has a dynamic prayer life. And part of what makes it dynamic is that he allows prayer to cover every aspect of his life. Then in verse 2, he says, now enter it not into judgment with your servant. Now the reason he doesn't want to be judged is for in your sight, no one living is righteous, right? Don't judge me, because not only am I not righteous, I do not know one other human being in the world that is righteous. So don't judge me. So David now, he is acknowledging, right? He is clearly, I'm guilty. I can't stand before you in judgment. But notice what he does. For the enemy has persecuted my soul, and he has crushed my life to the ground, and he has made me dwell in darkness like those that have been long dead. Therefore, my spirit is overwhelmed within me. My heart within me is distressed. I remember the days of old, and I meditated on your works, and I I muse on the work of your hands. I mean, that's the way it is, isn't it? You get depressed, and you start thinking about the good old days, and you start thinking about those times where, well, God worked here. Why ain't he working now? You know, I remember God answering this prayer, and this is half the prayer request that prayer request was. Why isn't God helping me now? And so he starts getting bummed out. Why God worked in the past, why isn't he working now? But notice he says, I spread out my hands to you, and my soul longs for you in a thirsty land. Answer me speedily, O Lord. My spirit fails. Do not hide your face from me, lest I be put like those who go down into the pit. Cause me to hear your loving kindness in the morning, for in you I do trust. Cause me to know the way in which I should walk, for I lift up my soul to you. Deliver me, O Lord, from my enemies, and in you I take shelter. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. Your spirit is good. Lead me in the land of uprightness. Revive me, O Lord, for your name's sake, for your righteousness' sake. Bring my soul out of trouble. In your mercy, cut off my enemies and destroy all of those that afflict my soul, for I am your servant. Now, notice, isn't it interesting that in verse 2, he acknowledges guilt. He acknowledges sin. Look, I can't stand to bear up under your judgment because, you know, I'm human and all humans are frail. But notice that he does not allow his sinfulness to hinder him from coming to God in prayer. Now, again, if we regard iniquity in our heart, God will not hear us. But that word regard there, it means that there is an unwillingness on my part to deal with it. I'm not going to acknowledge it. I'm not going to confess it before God. If that is my position to my sin, well, therefore, I might as well just talk to an empty room as to talk to God, because he's not going to listen to me because I am regarding sin in my heart. But David is not doing that. You see, when sin comes to your conscious understanding, it's like a child that's done something wrong. That child can either run away from the parent and then really get it at some point, or the child can just turn to the parent, run to the parent, and seek forgiveness, seek mercy, seek restoration. And that's what David is doing here. So it doesn't matter how sinful of a past we've had. It doesn't matter what weaknesses we're struggling with. You just acknowledge them before God and you take them to God in prayer. Well, then finally, 144, we read, blessed be the Lord my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle, my loving kindness and my fortress, my high tower and my deliverer, my shield, and the one in whom I take refuge, who subdues the people under me. Now, notice in two verses, you've got 11 personal pronouns, right? I mean, this guy has got a personal relationship with God. If you don't have a personal relationship with God, then you don't have much of a relationship with God at all. He says, Lord, what is man that you would take knowledge of him? Or the son of man that you are mindful of him? Man is like a breath, and his days are as a passing shadow. Again, David was overwhelmed by this concept that God had an interest in him. Now remember David's story. Again, it kind of takes us back to what we covered last time we were in Psalms. That here's a young man who is rejected by his dad. He's rejected by his brothers. He's a nobody from a nobody town and a nobody family. And God takes this nobody and he establishes him as the king in Israel. He gives him a promise that your son is going to be the promised Messiah that is going to deliver the world. And David was constantly blown away by that. You know, who am I that you would do such a thing? And not only that word mindful there in verse 3, maybe your translation might say account, but the Hebrew, it means to weave. That not only have you taken an interest in me, not only do you know me, but you are weaving. And the word can also mean to invent. That as David looked over his life, he saw This is a plan of God. I mean, that's the only... How else can you explain a rejected, you know, shepherd boy from, you know, Nowhereville? How can you explain that kid becoming king of the people of God? How can you explain that other than this was a plan of God? And he was blown away by that. And we should be blown away by that. That God knows us. God has taken an interest in us. God is weaving his plan in and out of our lives. And that plan that he has for us is eternal, where we, like David, will rule and reign with the Lord throughout all the ages to come. So he was blown away by that. He says, bow down your heavens, O Lord, and come down and touch the mountain, and they shall smoke, flash forth lightning and scatter them. Shoot out your arrows and destroy them. Stretch out your hand from above and rescue me and deliver me from great waters, from the hand of the foreigners and those mouths that speak lying words, and those on the right hand right hand is at the right hand of falsehood. And I will sing a new song to you, O God. On a harp of 10 strings will I sing praise to you, the one who gives salvation to kings, who delivers David his servant from the deadly sword. Rescue me and deliver me from the hand of foreigners, whose mouths speak lying words, whose right hand is the right hand of falsehood, that our sons may be as plants that grow up from their youth, and that our daughters may be pillars sculptured in a palace style, and that our barns may be full, supplying all kinds of produce, that our sheep may bring forth thousands and tens of thousands in our fields, and that our oxen may be well laden, and that there is no breaking in or going out, and that there is no outcry in our streets. Happy are the people who are in such a state. Happy are the people whose God is Lord. Now, here's the interesting thing about this, is that the Hebrew would indicate that the first half of verse 15 is a question. In other words, he's not making a statement that happy are the people that have all of these things, but it's a question. Are people who have all these things happy? And what's he talking about? He's talking about prosperity. He's talking about good health. He's talking about long life and all of these things. But then he asks the question, look, is a person happy who is into these things? Is happiness produced by having all of these things? Now, obviously, we think that it is, right? I mean, obviously, these are the things that we spend the lion's share of our time and energy on. Good health and prosperity and long life. I mean, these are the things that we're seeking after. But David is asking the question, look, is this really what produces happiness? Now, I don't know if you saw 60 Minutes last week, but they had Thomas Perkins on there, and a very intriguing guy. He's the guy that was behind the whole biotech explosion, and he became just a multi-billionaire. And all of the interview took place really in and around this massive yacht that is a technological marvel. It is the largest and it is the fastest private yacht in the world. It cost this guy $180 million. Imagine $180 million on a boat. I mean, it was a nice boat, I'm telling you. And what was interesting is he's very proud of this thing. You know, it's the fastest, it's the biggest, it's the most expensive and all of this stuff. And you can tell, I mean, he's genuinely happy about it. And then they go on with the interview. But then as they get to the end of the interview, it's discovered he's selling the boat. Now, what I found intriguing about it is that, I mean, here's a guy who was thrown in, I don't know how many years of his life, and of course, how much treasure he's poured into this, but it was his baby, and he was building this. This was going to be something that was going to really trip his trigger. Well, like so many things in life that you pursue when you think this is going to do it for you, that once you get it, you think, didn't really do it for me. I think there's got to be something else. And he was honest about it. He said, well, you know, it really is the pursuit, isn't it? I mean, you know, you long for it and you hunt it and you design it and you buy it and, you know, you build it and you do all of these, and then you get it and then you realize, nope, must be something else, and you got to move on. And that is what David's point is. You want a happy life? A happy life is not found in the things that he lays out here in verse 12 through verse 14. A happy life is what he says at the end of verse 15. Happy are the people whose God is Lord. In other words, happy are the people who are living in a lordship relationship with God. A lot of people acknowledge God. A lot of people attend church. And a lot of those people are miserable. Happiness in the believer is always discovered when they are walking in submission to their Lord. Not only Jesus as Savior, but also Jesus as Lord. And as we make him Lord, the fruit of that lordship relationship that we have with him is going to be fulfillment and happiness in life. So I think we ought to be praying that we have happy lives. And therefore, we ought to be praying that we have lives that are submitted to Jesus being Lord.